Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. Conversations about Kenpo and the martial arts and whatever else we happen to come across. I am Reggie Darden, and the guest I have with me today is Denise Plowman. And yeah, we're just going to kind of jump right in here and find out, you know, tell us how Kenpo found you and just kind of your journey from the beginning.
Thanks, Reggie. Thanks for inviting me on.
So yeah, so well, I guess we'll kind of just go ahead and give a little bit of my background. I started Kenpo in the mid '90s after seeing The Perfect Weapon with Jeff Speakman. As I think many Kenpo folks got their start that way. I, you know, trained for about 2-3 years and left for the Army. And while I was in the Army, did a little bit of Taekwondo, a little bit of Hapkido, a little bit of boxing. After I got out of the military, I wanted to start training again, but couldn't find a school that I liked. I then kind of stumbled on my other love, which is Capoeira. And I've been doing that coming up on 17 years now. You know, still always kept my love for Kenpo, and finally found a school that met my needs. And I've been training there for about 3 years now, fairly recently. I got my green belt, so just really enjoying the journey there. And can't wait for what's next. And, you know, that's just kind of my little quick summary of what I've been doing. I've also been kind of eyeballing some other arts, thinking about getting back into Hapkido and doing some Kali as well. But, you know, with life and the podcast and everything else going on, I need more hours in the day to do everything. But, you know, we'll kind of see where the journey takes us, and just looking forward to what's coming next. So, so yeah, if you could go ahead and how did you get started in Kenpo? And
sure. Well, first, congratulations on your green belt.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, that's always an accomplishment, no matter where you're at in Kenpo. So for me, I started in the 90s as well, too, around 1993, and my son at that time was around 6, and we were watching, there was a new Bruce Lee movie out about Bruce Lee with Jason Scott Lee.
Oh, yes, Dragon.
And we were watching that, and he had some interest that he wanted to do it, so I thought, well, maybe this is something that he and I could do together. And there happened to be a Kung Fu school that was real close to my house, and so I decided to drive over there and talk to them and see about their program and such, and they were closed. So I was like, I'm the kind of person that when I decide I want to do something, I kind of want it now. I don't want to wait. So I knew there was another school not too far that just opened up down the road that I passed by every day coming home from work, which was Boise Kenpo Karate. And so I stopped in there and signed up for lessons. And that's kind of where it began, was because the Kung Fu school was closed. So in 1993, I started there. Steve Moore, who was the owner, just had opened that school up. He had just got back up. He was down in West LA training with at the West LA school with Mr. Parker and the group that was down there for many years, and decided to move back up to Boise. He was originally from Boise and had began his Kenpo training early on with Mr. Rod Boslow back then. Anyway, he moved back and opened a school, and I began training there in 1993, or 94, I think it was January. And then from there, we've actually still have been training together now. It's been 30 years. I was promoted to first degree black belt. At that time, we were under the American Kenpo Karate System, which was aligned with Jeff Speakman at that time. So I tested in Vegas. I believe it was the second camp that they held down there for my first degree black belt. At that time, we had four schools in our area that we were all associated with in the same Kempo organizations for a year. And at that time, I was the first woman to be promoted to black belt in Kempo in the state of Idaho at that time. So that was kind of an accomplishment. In 1999, Mr. Moore decided he wanted to go full time into law enforcement. He was a reserve officer for many years. And so I made the decision to take over the school. I also worked full time. I worked for the Veterans Health Administration. I started there back in 1981, and I retired actually from there after 37 years. So I was working full time for the VA, and then I opened up my school, and I was there about 6 days a week as well too. So I had some pretty full days for quite a while. And so I managed a school on the nights and during the weekends, and I worked with, again, there was three other schools in our area that we partnered up and did camps together. We held a tournament twice a year together, the Northwest Karate Tournament for many years. And then throughout that course, I also started training some amateur full contact kickboxers with the help of our coach out of San Jose. And so I had some fighters that we were doing that for a while. And then in 2011, I was promoted in my career at the VA, and it required me to do a lot of travel. So I was gone at least 1 to 2 weeks a month. And it was, you know, I had some really good instructors that helped me keep the school going and such, but it just, wasn't able to put in the time and the effort that I felt was there for my students. And so I made the decision that to close the school because of my career change. And I had a lot more time involved with that than I did previously because of the position that I took. So I just didn't feel right not being able to commit full time to the students and give them everything that they needed. I started teaching, just continued teaching a handful of them out of my garage that had been with me for many, many years. And then from there, I kind of took a break for about a year because I had been doing this since before full time with both the career and both the school full time. And I just kind of had a moment there of a burnout for about a year or two. But then in 2017, I retired from the VA. And I was fortunate that I was able to retire at 56. So I have plenty of time ahead of me. And so I kind of reestablished myself back into, not that I ever was away from it, but I recommitted to my Kempo and to teaching and my training and such. So reemphasized that, started taking up a few more students in my school. Mr. Sepulveda I'm fortunate enough, moved here about 20 years ago. So he's easily accessible. So I started taking direct lessons with Mr. Sepulveda, as well as I still train with my instructor once a week. We do what we call senior Kempo, which is in relation to both of our ever-growing age. And so from there, I didn't feel like I was getting the workout like I used to have when I had my school and stuff. So I enrolled, we have a school here, SBG Idaho, it was Combat Fitness, but they're under the SBG program, which is an international program that trains in Muay Thai and Jiu Jitsu, and they have boxing and MMA and that. So I began training in Muay Thai there because it really was familiar to me with the kickboxing that we had at my school. And then in Jiu Jitsu, and in 2022, I decided to do the Jiu Jitsu class as well too, because I just felt there was kind of a void there of what do we need to do when we go to the ground? And so it's not so much as trying to acquire rank, or definitely not competing or any of that kind of stuff, but I just wanted a skill set to add to what I already know, to take to the ground, some simple things that when I teach women self-defense or teach my students, something that if you're on the ground to get up and get out, not to sit there and stay to try to submit somebody or anything like that. And then in 2022, I was inducted into the Kempo Hall of Fame in Las Vegas. And I still continue to travel around the country, going to various schools and camps and seminars. And back in 2020, I was asked to be a part of Barbara White had begun a Kempo Women's Symposium in 2014 at the 50th anniversary of the IKC. And they wanted to continue that, but COVID had hit. So she had reached out to me and wanted to know if I wanted to be a part of a panel where we would do a Zoom symposium event. And so highlighting, basically at that time, it was highlighting the women that are in Kempo and talking about our journeys and the challenges and the successes and stuff that we've had with a group of people. And then she asked me to come on board permanently. So we created the Kempo Women's Symposium back in 2000 during COVID, started hosting two times a year, a live Zoom event with a variety of different women in Kempo on an international level, trying to bring them in to where other people could hear about their stories or what made them successful or how they run their school or whatever our topic of conversation was for that time. So we're 4 years into that and have a pretty good social media presence with we switched our name up this year to the International Women of Kempo because we expanded so much out there that we really wanted the name to be more in tune to what our mission statement and what our goal is. And so we have a board of 10 people that we meet regularly once a month for our team meetings. Our goal is to host two Zoom events a year, highlighting the women in Kempo in a variety of different ways on an international level. And we also now have our Latin American representative, Marisol, who is starting to put together the symposiums for Latin America. So down there in her neck of the woods. So it's really kind of grown. And so that's a lot of where my focus is these days, as well as to continue that focus on the women in Kempo, highlighting, so far have highlighted over 100 women on our Facebook page, just bringing them to light, sharing their stories, trying to promote the conversation so that somebody may have a question, but they're afraid to ask, but they hear somebody else has had a challenge and how they were able to work through that challenge in their training or however life, you know, might play a part in, like you were talking earlier, not enough time in the day, maybe time management or whatever that may be. There might be some answers out there through the people that have been training that normally you wouldn't have the opportunity to talk with because they're not in your core group, in your school and such. So I am currently a 6-degree black belt in the advanced Kempo training system, which is under Senior Master of the Art, John Sepulveda. We are we're celebrating his 60th year in Kempo this year. So that's kind of cool to be a part of that. And I have been with him since my whole career in Kempo. So for the last 30 years. So right now I'm retired. I have my twin grandkids that I take care of, not as often as I used to. I had them full time when I first retired, but now they're in school. So they're a big part of my life. They're 7 years old and I still train out in my garage and still travel around to various camps and seminars. Was just at the IKC a couple weeks ago and that's where I'm at.
Fantastic. I like that. To go back to those early days, one, just because I'm curious, do you happen to know what style of kung fu that school was?
I only remember it being a Shaolin kung fu is what I saw on the sign. So I'm not well versed at all in the different styles of kung fu, so I couldn't tell you.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha. And then, did you have any kind of interest or knowledge about the martial arts before you started training?
You know, I really didn't. I knew about the school that a lot of the black belts in our organization came from was out of down off Main Street. There wasn't a lot of schools around in that area. So I knew of some people that trained there prior to, you know, maybe 10 years back. But I didn't really have a lot of knowledge about them. I was always pretty athletic growing up, so I was heavily involved in sports and that. But then, like you say, life happened and, you know, got married and had my son. And so your responsibilities and your direction changes a little bit. But this was an opportunity to kind of get back into that active lifestyle. Had no idea it would take me where I'm at. I was doing it really for my son, but he lost interest at some point and I stayed with it. And it just kind of filled a void that I had been missing for a long time. That first part of it being just involved in some kind of athletic activity. And then with Kempo, then it just became a passion. I mean, and I just was sucked into it to where I was training 6 days a week, 3 to 4 hours a day. And then eventually started teaching and then taking the school over.
Yeah, I always find it so interesting, you know, hearing different people's stories about you know, kind of making it their life, but yet they didn't start off that way. So, like, I look at myself in that, you know, I was always a fan of the martial arts, as you know, grew up watching, you know, kung fu movies and Bruce Lee and all these different things, and then, you know, I finally got to the point where I could start training myself and just loving it and doing it. But I hear a lot of stories of people that are like, oh, well, like I didn't even want to go to the class, or I wasn't interested, or, yeah, you know, I just went with my friend, and, you know, the friend ends up dropping out, and then, yeah, the person that didn't want to go, not only do they continue training, but, you know, they become a teacher, they make it, you know, they make it their life. And that's always kind of, it's always funny and interesting to me that there's so many people that have really made this their life when that wasn't, you know, even on the radar for them when they started. So.
Well, and I used to see that with some of my students. I would have, especially the kids, I didn't have a large kid population. The majority of my students were adults, but I can recall two or three kids that came in and I was thinking, man, they're not going to make it past the first 3 months. You know, it's just, just who they were and how, you know, they, you know, being young and amazing enough, they were the ones that proved me wrong and were with me for years. Whereas the people that brought them in, you know, they went off into different directions and such. So it's interesting of how that spark gets lit and then how it stays there for some people that you wouldn't even think, you know, it would. So I don't judge anymore based upon that, because I have been wrong several times in that regards to, you know, what makes somebody want to continue to stay in my experience, Kempo, because I have a little bit with the Muay Thai and the Jiu Jitsu, but my, you know, most of my experience is with the Kempo. So what makes people stay in it? So it's just that spark that gets lit and, you know, when it's there and they end up turning into some of your best students.
Now, back in, you know, in the early days, did the teaching side of it, you know, hit you early on, or was that something that, you know, kind of came later down the road? Like, when did that side of it interest you?
So I started teaching, our school being relatively young in that, I was very fortunate with my instructor. I started teaching at a blue belt just because young school and trying to get, you know, we were growing in population. And so I found that when I started teaching, it was a whole nother aspect or perspective of the martial arts, because you really learn more when you start to teach, because it forces you to be able to, you have to know how to communicate that to your students in the appropriate way. And there's, you find yourself, or I did at that time, I would second guess myself all the time, and you know, I'd pull out the manuals and start reading them. Is it a right foot or is it a left foot? I mean, things that you know automatically. But now then when you're starting to having to communicate that with somebody new coming in, you start to second guess on whether or not you are doing it correctly. But that, to me, really reinforced my foundation in Kenpo, was being able to start teaching at Blue Belt and then understanding, having a better understanding of the system and what was needed. I think I was, it was very advantageous for me to have that happen. Now, that didn't happen in all schools. Not all instructors felt that it was appropriate, but I was very fortunate with my instructor, who had several of us actually, that once we reached Blue and Green Belt would start taking a student, you know, you're not, you're taking just maybe two or three students. But it really helped develop the school, but it also helped develop my ability to communicate the information. And it wasn't always right. And there would always be a eye roll from my instructor, you know, that later on we would talk about is, what was that? And I said, oh, and I, was that a miscommunication? You know, and so again, another learning experience. But we were fortunate in that regards. And so from there, you know, you just develop your Kenpo, you become more confident in it, the more that you're teaching light sword over and over and over and over again. And that just helps build you up to become a better martial artist. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. As of this recording, I did my first instructor. Well, I led my first class last night as we're recording today. And, I do love the teaching side. So in my Capoeira life, I ran our group for a number of years. I, you know, inherited the school, so to speak. And, before that, at the first Kenpo school I was at, I did kind of help out a little bit. I didn't officially join the instructors program because I knew I was leaving for the military. So, I definitely get that, you know, the sense and the feeling and the perspective of, you know, being in that role and, helping out others. And, you know, you learn so much about yourself as well as the students. So.
Well, and it teaches, I can honestly say that my career with VA, I would not have gotten to the level in the VA had it not been for Kenpo. And part of that was the ability to interpersonal interaction and communication and learning how to get up in the front of a group of people and speak. And obviously, to me, it's what I tell people, the more you know about the subject, the more confident you are, the easier it is to talk about it to a group of people. And so that really helped develop that confidence, and the ability to do a self-assessment of how you did and take constructive criticism so that you can improve, really parlayed into my career and helped me to move up the ladder to get to a pretty high position within the VA. I don't think I would have ever done that without my experience of being on the mat and teaching in Kenpo and learning from that trial. You know, there's always trial and error, but learning from that. And then it transitioned to where I'm learning also in my career outside and then bringing that also into, the school, the skill sets that you learn on both sides of it and kind of meshing them together. So that it really helped develop for me a stronger foundation to help with the relationship with my students and such.
Very nice. Very nice. So you mentioned in your training, so you were under Jeff Speakman for quite a while. I take it that this was kind of before he, developed the 5.0 system. You mentioned that there wasn't the ground element.
We were always under Mr. Sepulveda, but our schools had agreed to go into his organizations.
Mm-hmm.
We were, Mr. Sepulveda has always been our leader as such. And he was partnering with Mr. Speakman at that time, even though it was, you know, headlined as Mr. Speakman's organization. So we were with him for a while there. But then we just decided to go off in our own direction for the needs of what we were looking for. And that was, I think it was just about the time he might have been starting 5.0. So we weren't really, we weren't with him when that was fully developed or implemented. He might have been in the beginning stages of it. So yeah, we were pre that. But we were still really an organization that was aligned under Mr. Sepulveda.
Okay. I like that. I just was kind of curious if, you know, there were, you know, if you saw maybe the kind of the signs that Mr. Speakman was kind of going in that direction, or, you know, if there was any kind of little hints to that, or.
You know, it wasn't just him. I mean, back then, even within our group, we had several people, several of the guys that I train with, mainly down in California and that, but around, you know, so we're international. Mr. Spilda has schools all over the world and stuff, but core group is down there where he started where he had a school before he retired and moved to Boise. He was down there in Santa Clara and that, but it wasn't just in our group. It was throughout. There was a lot of people that, you know, UFC just started out back then. It was brand new. Gracie's obviously dominated because nobody knew the ground game. And so there was interest to see, you know, should that also be applicable to what we're doing? So I know a lot of the guys that started getting into the full contact kickboxing, and that's why I implemented it at my school as well, too. We kind of went away from tournament sparring and more into the continuous fighting and into the full contact. And then there was also a handful of them that started doing the grappling arts as well, too, and integrating that in with our Kempo. So at our camps that we would have, we had several classes on some groundwork and stuff like that. So it was, I think, not just with his group, but I think there was a feeling through a lot of people that maybe that's something that needed to be looked at and maybe integrated in, or, you know, just give it a chance. And so, I think that was, it was kind of a sign of the times for a lot of people at that time. And again, probably due to the UFC and the starting of that and what people were seeing in, you know, reality of that MMA style of fighting and how much of, at that time, the Gracies had the dominance of that. But that's not the case now because everybody now cross trains and everything. So,
the UFC, really. You know, open the world's eyes to you know, grappling and having that in, you know, in the tool bag, and you know, really kind of changed people's outlook and idea of you know, what kind of skills you know you should have in these, you know, kind of combat situations. So
yeah, I mean, it was, I don't know that it, you know, some of the old school guys, I don't know if you know Seagon Labowney or, you know, Mr. Kelly or all those guys back in that were with Mr. Parker way back when who were fighters, you know, and they were the old school fighter, Benny Urquidy's and that. So they were kind of the champions at that time of the where the full contact kickboxing came out. But also, if you look at the old school tournaments back then, they weren't wearing pads. It was you know, it wasn't bare knuckle, but it was you know, the contact was definitely there. And you hear and I used to hear the stories from Mr. Labowney and all those guys that were back in the 60s and that they're fighting. So there was an idea. You know, and there was also judo, I think, played a part in a lot. Well, obviously with Mr. Parker, but a lot of the other guys as well, too, like Seagon Labowney, big in judo. I know my instructor did judo when he was younger. And, you know, so there was kind of that concept. It just hadn't quite been brought together as much in the public eye to where you see it competitively like they did when they started doing it in the UFC.
Gotcha. So to kind of change gears a little bit, I'm curious, is there any kind of stories that maybe kind of stick out in your mind, particularly when you were a colored belt, that, you know, maybe kind of humorous or just, you know, a particular time that kind of sticks out in your mind that maybe wanted to share?
Without implicating anybody?
You can use it.
But they know. They would know. Man, you know, I don't know. One, it was so long ago, and you're asking my old brain to think of stuff. I mean, what really sticks out most for me in all of this is that I've been fortunate enough that the people I train with, I have been training with them for 30 years or 25 or 30 years. And, you know, we do have a lot of stories, and there's, you know, from camps and seminars and stuff like that. But I think what really sticks out the most for me is the fact that they're family and on a international level, and that, you know, there's a lot of love between all of us. And even though we're out there, we aren't as heavy handed as we used to be. Mm-hmm. I think maybe one story, I remember having a black eye, who knows from what or whatever. And at that time I was married. I was giving my husband a bunch of crap as we're walking through the store. Every time he'd look at me, I would kind of flinch. Like, stop it. I'm like, what? You know, but there's a lot of war stories of how we used to train way back then. And you know, we ate dirt, and we were training in the dirt up at camp and rolling around in pine needles. And there was some pretty hardcore training. It's since has not so much anymore these days. It's the training's there, but it's different. It's probably smarter. And especially if you're a school owner, you know, some of the stuff that we used to do way back then would not fly in this day and age. You would lose students.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I had a lot of those kind of stories of just nights of ground and pound and just feeling like that, you know, nothing you did worked. I remember when Mr. Moore, so when I started, you couldn't fight until you were a yellow belt. So when you became a yellow belt, you were invited to come to fighting class. But as I said, at that time, the school was very young. And so fighting class really became nothing more than Mr. Moore and all of his friends who were black belts came in and just basically used all of us lowly yellow belts and orange belts as practice.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if we learned a lot from that, but it was, yeah, we felt like we were fed to the lions back then because they were just, they had their way with us, and we had no skills whatsoever. So that was kind of interesting to grow up in there. So I would say maybe that would be some of the stories that we had. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. So taking, you know, the perspective, you know, or like, what is your perspective on training, you know, training as a woman with, you know, kind of, you know, the martial arts and mm-hmm. you know, maybe Kenpo, might be a little bit more guilty of this than other arts, but you know, it being kind of the boys club sort of thing, did you have, you know, kind of, was it like
yeah, I know what you're saying. So I have been very fortunate in my organization that I had really didn't have to deal with what some would call misogyny or the old boys club, or that I was never, ever treated any differently. There was, I was expected to step up like everybody else. But Mr. Sepulveda would tell you that the women in the organization usually have to work twice as hard to get to where they need to do, because you are going kind of against the society standards and what people see. But outside of that, I mean, it's there. It still exists. I still hear comments and such. I think it's gotten better. And that's one of the focuses that we talk about for the International Women of Kenpo, is how can it be to where we have a conversation some point where it's about a martial artist and not about a woman martial artist or a male martial artist, but we're just a martial artist, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're not there yet. It's been a while, but I can give you an example. In the last year or so, I was listening to an interview with some of the old school Kempo guys, and a comment was made from one of them that says, well, when I have women that come into my schools, you know, I'm going to teach them to hit like a man. And I was like, well, what does that mean? Because I know men that can't hit, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand the concept that he was trying to get to, but in this day and age, that's not really relevant. I can tell you in my other life where I train at down at SBG Idaho, they got professional MMA fighters, women down there that, you know, I'll put up against any man. They are phenomenal fighters. So it's really more about how do you change the conversation? What we really try to promote is being able to maintain that female audience at your schools and understanding why somebody might leave versus how do you keep them there? How do you get them up to, you know, your higher ranks and stuff? And understanding what those challenges may be. And it's hard to understand unless you've actually sat down and had a conversation with some of the women. Why do some of the women come into the martial arts? Could be because of the fact that they've had trauma on the outside, you know? So that's another area that you have to be able to identify and understand the reasons why you might not be able to teach them the same way as somebody else because of that trauma that they have had. But it's gotten better. In some respects, I still think that old school mentality is there, but it's also a social norm. You know, it's just you're raised as a girl to be a certain way. You're raised as a guy or a boy, don't hit girls. And so there's a conflict that happens when you get into a school or training to where you've been raised that you're not supposed to hit a woman. Well, then how do you do that training? And so I think that's one of the biggest barriers to get over is to have that understanding that it's okay to have the physical contact within reason, you know, obviously, and you need to communicate that on both sides of it. But I think that's the biggest challenge is being able to make sure that the women are getting the training that they need, because if anything's going to happen out in the real world, as far as being attacked, they're more percentage wise is probably going to happen to them. So are you teaching them about what it feels like to be grabbed really hard and not necessarily punched, but pulled and thrown to the ground or whatever, so that they have that understanding of what that feels like. And so their body doesn't stress out, doesn't go into shock, and they don't know what to do. And so you have to find that way to communicate that training. And you got to get the guys as well, too, to be able to provide that experience as the attacker to some degree. And so it's just really partnering up on both sides and talking to each other. The one thing that I always tell everybody, I will have women talk to me about, you know, somebody's hit me too hard or whatever. And the first thing I ask them, I said, did you tell them to, you know, bring it back? Well, no. First thing out the gate is you have to communicate. You don't just take it. You have to be able to communicate and say, hey, you know, bring it back a little bit. I can't take that right now. Let me work my technique or whatever. Because if they end up fearful of being hit and that, then they start to shut down and they're not learning anything. So, but they also have a responsibility that they need to communicate to their partner who they're working with, the level of impact that they want. That you have to build that trust with your training partners. So if nothing else, I think that's the big key in the schools is building that trust so everybody feels comfortable, but is still getting as realistic of an experience of training as they can. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I like that.
I mean, it's kind of like, I would ask you, you know, when I have conversations with men and stuff like that, I would ask you, what do you think the challenges are in working with women?
Well, I would say a lot of it comes from just, you know, kind of the old school kind of how we're brought up. Like you mentioned, you know, most men are told, you know, yeah, you're not supposed to, you know, hit women. My mother is, of course, the exception to that. And she always told me if a female hits you for no reason, then you need to hit her back. So yeah. That may be controversial in today's world, but you know, okay. That's
well, I think it goes with the say to Mr. Parker, whatever the attitude is, so is the response. But then mm-hmm. you also have a responsibility. So if you've got a 7-year-old that is giving you a bunch of lip and hitting and kicking it, you're obviously not going to go punch him and knock him out, right? It doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly. Gender, whatever. You have to take in consideration. You know what? You know, is it easy for you just to walk away? You have to understand that it's you should be responding to the level that is of the type of attack that is coming at you, male, female, or whatever. Because there's some women out there that are crazy. And and especially if there are, you know, if drugs are involved in something like that. So they could be very, very dangerous as well, too. So
yeah,
I think you just have to, it's not a written rule of how it's going to be. You have to address the situation as it occurs and knowing what your skill level is, what your training is or whatever, you should be able to assess and to see what level do I need to take it.
Mm-hmm.
So a woman that's hitting you that's maybe 5'5" and maybe you're 6'3", are you going to tell me that you're going to hit her back and knock her out? I mean, to me, it's not really a gender thing. It's a size thing. So come mm-hmm. on, what else could have been done at that point in time? It's not about whether you're a male or a female, but it's about realistically, what is the situation at that point in time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I think when, you know, people join a school, you know, there's that understanding of like, this is what you signed up for. So, you know, I'm not going to inherently, you know, take it easy or be harder on you because of your gender or because right. of, you know, whatever else. It's like, we're all equals, you know, when we enter the studio. So,
Well, that's a good point because I there had been times that the assumption was because, you know, again, majority of the students I had were adults and the majority and probably 80% were men. And I had, you know, society norms is that, oh, you know, the guy walking in, he should be able to fight. Well, then I start working with him and the person doesn't have an ounce of athletic ability whatsoever to mm-hmm. be able to throw a punch at that. So that's bad on me because I made the assumption that he should have some kind of knowledge so I had to throw that out the window, like you say, and it's anybody walking in the door. It doesn't matter about gender as much as understanding that individual and figuring out where it is that you need to start teaching them and understanding what the contact level, are they able to take more or less, or how can you work up to where it, you know, increases over time and how do you titrate that as you're doing it? So it's really should be a good instructor, in my opinion. It should be based upon the individual's ability to learn and to accept and not just a general norm of based upon what somebody looks like or what their gender is.
Exactly. All right. So I got one more question before we head into our lightning round.
Okay.
So what is your thoughts on just kind of the future of Kenpo? Maybe where would you like to see it heading, or where do you think it's heading, or just kind of your thoughts on the future of Kenpo?
I think the future of Kenpo, what people need to understand, you know, unfortunately, not just in the Kenpo world, but in throughout, I mean, there's a lot of politics. That was the one thing that when I closed my school, I didn't have to deal with the politics that went with that anymore on an administrative level. I could just train Kenpo. But to me, Kenpo is ever evolving. And it's based upon reality of what today is like. And that as long as we do that, of course, it's not going to be exactly like it was back in, you know, the early days. And nothing ever is. Change always happens. You have to change with the times. But as long as there's that understanding that it's ever evolving and people are dedicated to, you know, still teaching, you know, what Mr. Parker taught in that. But I see I see it now, you know, you bring up Mr. Speakman, there's an example of that, of how, you know, groundwork has been played into it. I've seen it in other schools where their fighting has changed or some of the techniques have changed a little bit. I think as long as you, the core base is always there, and that it's always, to me, important to teach the history. Where we start to lose Kempo is when we don't teach the history anymore. We don't talk about the founders and who was and why we're where we're at. We lose that history, you know, because there's no, if you go to any class or camp now and you ask people to raise their hands, it meant Mr. Parker, you know, obviously that's few and far between. And I never met him. He passed before I started training as well, too. But we're also losing a lot of our seniors now, too. And so what I like to tell everybody is if you have the opportunity to train with these individuals that have been in Kempo for all these years, take that opportunity because it may never come around again. Talk to them, ask them stories, know your history. And as long as we know the history and all of that, we can carry Kempo forward. But if we start to lose the history and where we come from and why we're where we're at now, I can see it kind of vanishing in the future. Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I'm doing this podcast is, you know, to get to talk to those people and the people that are close to those people so that we can, you know, preserve that history, preserve those knowledge, preserve the stories, so that, you know, we can allow the art to evolve and, you know, we can all kind of grow together. So, I think that's huge.
And I can't reiterate that enough, you know, because the opportunities are always out there. They're always out there, but people do not take those opportunities to invest in their training. They stay within their group and, you know, being that little froggy in the well, looking up, thinking that's the whole universe. And I learned so much by being able to go out and train with a variety of people outside of our organization as well, too. And it was never frowned upon. And I just encourage people to do that. Get to know the community. Get to know the family, the extended family that's out there. And it will, you will be a better Kempoist for it if you do that.
I agree. So to move to our lightning round here. I got a few little questions there. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Well, isn't everybody's favorite technique five swords?
That is definitely.
Yeah. I mean, really to me, any of the combo hand combo techniques, the 1-2 punch kind of combo tech, those are probably some of my favorite because they correlate in with fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gotcha. Nice. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
My favorite form would probably be four. Favorite set, actually, my favorite set is stance set two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if I had to pick.
Okay. Yeah. Right on. I like it. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
I'd have to pick Mr. Parker.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Anyone else that you want to add to that? I should probably start changing that question to maybe two or three people. It's kind of interesting, you know, and all the people that I've talked to so far, I kind of always assumed everyone would immediately first say Ed Parker. But that actually is not the case, actually. I'm sure they're all thinking of it, but probably just it's like, well, it's a given to say that. So,
I'm kind of surprised
that people haven't said it more than that, or at least be that their first answer. So,
if nothing more than just to sit down and have a conversation, just to get to know the person that, I mean, I know him through obviously Mr. Sepulveda, who was, you know, a direct descendant of Mr. Parker, and then through my instructor, Mr. Moore. I mean, if I was going to say others in the Kempo world, I've been so fortunate to train with a lot of the seniors throughout the years that
there really hasn't been anybody that I haven't had an opportunity to do a class with or something. So it's man, it's hard to say.
No, that's
because
that's
I have been very fortunate in participating with many of the seniors, some that are no longer here. If nothing else, if I had the opportunity to bring back Sigon LeBounty, I would love to do that. Mm-hmm. We miss him dearly, but that man was just for a strong woman's advocate, support, and he's the reason that I continue a lot of it, that I continue going forward is his constant encouragement for me in that came out in many different ways.
But, yeah.
But also for the other people to have the opportunity to train with him. I can't really think of anybody that I haven't had the opportunity.
No, that's a great answer. Okay. So then the final question and the hardest of them all, in honor of Ed Parker's love of humor, do you have a joke to share?
A joke? Probably not one that you can put on a podcast. I'll just leave it at that.
That's a perfect answer. I like it.
Yeah. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, no, actually somebody else that I was speaking to recently, I mentioned that it's like, I kind of know the same like four or five jokes that I've been telling since way too young to be hearing such jokes. And
yeah,
I'm like, I don't know if I should share them on the
I could share. Well, my grandson is all of a sudden thinking he's a joke teller. Like I said, he's seven,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure how if he understands what's involved with the joke as to what makes it funny. Cause it doesn't make any sense. So I'm in that period. I could share some of his, but it would just leave people, questioning.
gotcha. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, thank you so much for being on. Now is the point for shameless self-promotion. So if there's anything that you want to bring up or say that we hadn't covered already, now is your time to...
You know, not necessarily for me, but if I do any kind of anything, it would be to just really thank those that have been a part of my training, all of my, what I call my boys down in San Jose. And obviously, you know, my instructor, Mr. Moore, who I've been with, again, we hit 30 years this year. We're still leaving Kempo love messages all over each other's bodies, so to speak. And then also just the mentoring and support of Mr. Sepulveda. And, you know, we're here celebrating his 60 years into Kempo this year. So
very nice.
That would be my plug, is just a thank you to my Kempo family, because I would not be here without the opportunity of being able to train and have a relationship with all of them, and going through the good and the bad times that we've all gone through, and being supportive and knowing that they're always there if I ever need them, and vice versa. So that would just be my plug.
Excellent. Well, I thank you
again. I do have one more plug. I do.
Go ahead.
For the International Women of Kempo team, we are getting ready to start to put together our next symposium, which will be, I believe, we set for April 6th. But I guess the one big plug, just to support our organization, if you're not a member of our Facebook page, to please reach out and do that. And if there's anybody in your Kempo life, your training, it doesn't matter rank or age or that you think would be someone that we could highlight their journey and promote them on our page, please DM me and we'll get that done. We really want to get everybody involved in highlighting all the women of Kempo.
Excellent.
That would be my plug.
Excellent. I like it. Well, yeah, thank you so much. I can't wait to get this episode together and get it out for everyone to hear. And just thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and we will be in touch. We'll be in touch soon.
Thanks, Reggie. Appreciate it. Right. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.